After months of conversations and bargains and deal-making, Wisconsin has a signed budget. Governor Tony Evers signed the plan yesterday.
This budget delivers on many of the important promises I made to the people of Wisconsin and makes progress towards fixing our roads, supporting schools, increasing funding for health care, and cutting taxes for working families.
The governor used his powerful veto pen, which allows him to delete words, numbers, and punctuation to make 78 partial vetoes to the $82 billion budget approved by the state's GOP-led legislature. Those changes include boosting education funding, eliminating a vehicle registration fee, decrease for large vehicles. There's a line for you as we explore this budget, 800-642-1234. Did this end in a compromise from your perspective? Are you happy that the budget is signed and lawmakers can move on to other efforts? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Laura White is back with us. She is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter, co-host of the WPR Politics podcast. Laurel, good morning.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So we saw those 78 items in the GOP budget with partial vetoes, but a big move in education funding. What did we learn there?
So the governor increased K-12 education funding in Wisconsin by about $65 million. He did that by tweaking the language for per pupil funding in Wisconsin just a little bit using that powerful veto pen he has. He added $63 a year per pupil, and that actually amounted to about an $87 million increase, but that overall increase went down to about $65 million because he also vetoed a roughly $18 million technology program that would have allowed schools to apply for state grant funding to buy personal computing devices. Evers essentially said he thought that money could be better spent elsewhere on programs that are more proven to close the achievement gap. That's what he said in his veto message.
So how much more will the governor's budget cost than what was proposed to him?
So actually, there's not a huge change in terms of overall cost between what the legislature passed last week and what the governor approved yesterday. That's because where the governor was able to increase some spending, he found kind of corresponding cuts in other parts of the budget. So it's roughly the same.
Well, let's hear how Republicans are reacting to this. And here's Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald.
Told you this was a good budget last week. I want to thank Governor Evers for signing the budget into law today with minimal changes, including full embracing the middle class tax cut.
So the middle class tax cut, it sounds like the majority leader is really pleased there with what the outcome was on this budget.
He was. You know, the Republican Senate Majority Leader had a press conference right after the governor signed the budget, and he really characterized the governor's action as one that was positive for Republican lawmakers. He said, you know, kind of as you heard him say there, the governor really signed into law a Republican budget. He didn't make too many changes. He said the changes he did make were minimal. The only thing that Senator Fitzgerald expressed some disappointment in were the changes the governor made to work requirements for programs like food stamps in Wisconsin. The governor did take away some of the funding that the state would have used to implement those work requirements, which are actually slated to expand later this year, as well as some state money that was going to be used to implement drug testing for some state public benefits as well.
Talking with Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter, and we're looking at the newly signed budget signed yesterday by Governor Evers. Laurel, not all Republicans responded positively, I understand. What was the reaction from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss?
So Assembly Speaker Voss really focused on those benefits changes, the work requirement changes. I think it's safe to say his statement was very powerfully worded and very critical. He essentially said the governor is, quote, intent on trapping people in welfare. He said the people of Wisconsin support these work requirements and drug testing requirements, and the governor is kind of subverting that with his veto messages and also taking away an incentive for people to remove themselves from these public benefit programs. It's a little bit in line with some of the language that we've heard from Republican lawmakers over the past few weeks. They've talked more about welfare in the state of Wisconsin, I think, recently than they had in the previous part of budget negotiations. They started characterizing the Medicaid expansion in Wisconsin as an expansion of welfare. So I think this focus on welfare, the welfare system in Wisconsin, by Voss in his reaction is pretty consistent with sort of a brewing message within the party in the state.
Something that popped out at me, Laurel, as I watched that press conference by the governor as he explained the budget from what he saw it, that he had really sharp words for Republicans, that they picked their voters and really essentially didn't follow the will of the people, and kind of speaking to gerrymandering there. What is he looking at in terms of a redistricting committee?
So the governor said he's going to reintroduce a proposal that would create a nonpartisan redistricting commission in Wisconsin. We've seen that sort of system in states like Iowa. The governor did include that in his overall budget proposal earlier this year, but Republican lawmakers took it out over the course of the budget negotiation, as they did with dozens of other proposals that the governor had initially put in there. So what he's saying there is that that should be a focus for the state of Wisconsin, particularly on the heels of that U.S. Supreme Court decision last week that struck down lawsuits challenging gerrymandered maps across the country. So Evers is going to make a big push, I think, when we see lawmakers come back in the fall, for them to at least debate and consider that nonpartisan gerrymandering commission. Now, we're not entirely sure what the levels of support are in the Republican Assembly and Senate for that proposal, but it's certainly not something that they have proposed in the past.
Healthcare was also certainly a focal point of the governor's budget. What did we see happen in healthcare?
So the governor, similarly to his rhetoric about the nonpartisan redistricting commission, he talked about reintroducing the Medicaid expansion when lawmakers come back in the fall. You know, he would obviously have to coordinate with Democratic lawmakers. The governor himself cannot introduce a bill into the state legislature. But he said that that Medicaid expansion was so important to him in this budget process that he believes it sort of deserves another strike at potentially making it through Wisconsin, another chance. Now, it's incredibly unlikely that that Medicaid expansion would move forward because it has very strong opposition within the Republican majority, and Republicans do have very strong majorities, particularly in this assembly.
In the last minute we have, what else struck you about this budget and how the governor approached it?
Well, I think it was interesting to see the governor comment on his consideration of vetoing the budget in its entirety. You know, we've talked about that possibility over the past several days. It would have been an unprecedented move for Governor Evers. A governor has never vetoed the entire state budget since we went to an executive budget in the 1930s. He said he decided not to do that, even though he strongly considered it, because he thought it would be a very partisan move, something that would contribute to sort of that bitterness and back and forth between the parties. And he said, Wisconsinites are tired of that sort of thing. I'm going to sign this budget in the spirit of compromise, even though, in his words, it's in many ways inadequate and falls pretty far short of what he proposed earlier this year.
Laurel, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter, co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. Coming up, it is the 4th of July, and we're considering the history of the American flag and other iconic flags. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about flags through history on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Our American flag goes by different names: Old Glory, the Stars and Stripes. It is the inspiration for our national anthem.
Oh, say, can you see by
Do you fly the American flag where you live? Why is it important to you? And what do you think the flag represents? Is it the only flag you fly, or do you raise the state flag? We're at 800-642-1234. Vanessa Cook is a history lecturer at UW-Madison. Vanessa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
So let's start with our flag, the Wisconsin flag. It is blue, and it is above the state capitol. Can you help us understand what is on it, what it looks like?
So the Wisconsin state flag that we know and love today, it was actually created back during the Civil War in the 1860s. And it has undergone some minor changes over time, but from the very beginning, it was blue. It always had that motto, forward, at the top, and it featured different workers. If you look at the details of the flag, there's a sailor, there's a miner. Of course, the badger is a reference to lead miners who were working and living underground, so that is on there and associated with the state. But I think it's interesting that it really focuses on workers, and I think the message of the flag from that beginning was, by working together, we can create a strong economy and move forward together. So to honor that flag today, to respect that flag today, not only can we show that respect by displaying it properly, but I think living up to the message and values of respecting all workers in the state, whether private sector or public sector, and knowing that we can move forward together.
There's also a shield in the center, which is our support for the U.S. Is that right?
Yeah, I had read that also. And again, in that shield, there are different symbols that just reference other industries. There's a reference to agriculture in there, again, mining, and I think an anchor also, you know, towards sailing and that industry, so shipping industry. So that, I think, the focus on workers is the most prominent there.
So much of your state's identity trying to get wrapped up on this piece of cloth, essentially, and each state having its own. Why do you think Wisconsin's is special, and it really maybe or maybe not reflects who this state really is?
Well, I grew up in Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania flag is also blue. It also has references to the economy and the workers, so I'm not sure that's just unique to Wisconsin. The Pennsylvania flag, for some reason, has two black horses that are very prominent, so that's a little different. But I think the motto forward is something unique and powerful for our state.
What do we know about that word? Where did it come from?
I actually don't know much about that.
So, you know, we treat the American flag with reverence. We place our hands to our heart during the Pledge of Allegiance, face the flag. How should we honor the Wisconsin flag?
Well, there is an extensive flag code for state flags, as there is for the national flag. So displaying it properly goes into that. But again, I think living up to the values of what that flag reflects and the unity of the workers and the citizens of the state.
We're talking flags, their historic meaning with Vanessa Cook. She's a history lecturer at UW-Madison. Do you fly the American flag where you live? Why is it important to you? What do you think the flag represents? Join in with your questions about flags as well, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Vanessa, what do we know as far as the history of our American flag, when it was first established?
Yes, the important First Flag Act, 1777, the founders thought it was very important to create a new flag as quickly as possible as a sign of independence from Great Britain, and also forging a new identity, trying to unite those 13 colonies that would soon become the 13 first states. And that unity is built into the design of the flag with the 13 stars and the 13 alternating stripes. So I think that reflects how important flags are in our political culture, that they wanted to create that new flag so quickly, as soon as possible. So the record is clear that they were resolved to do that. The record is less clear on the extent to which Betsy Ross was involved in the design of that flag, or even if she sewed the first flag. There's speculation from historians on both sides of that argument. And there is some circumstantial evidence to support both sides of that argument, but we don't have the hard evidence to know definitively what role she played in that.
But it's a lovely story.
Yes, it's a lovely story, and you can still go to Philadelphia and visit the Betsy Ross House.
Where did the colors come from? How did we get our colors? Red, white, and blue.
I think they were derived somewhat from the Union Jack, and the British flag, you know, had those colors in it. And in vexillology, the study of flags, those colors represent different values and concepts. So blue could mean justice or perseverance, red, courage, strength, power, and then the white, purity or innocence.
You had mentioned that the American flag makes you think of Francis Scott Key, and he wrote a poem that eventually became the lyrics for The Star-Spangled Banner. What do you think inspired him to write the words about the flag?
Well, there is that famous story. Francis Scott Key was off the coast of Maryland near Baltimore. He was actually a lawyer helping to negotiate the release of some prisoners of war that the British had in their custody. And he was kept captive on that ship, at least temporarily, because the British were planning to bombard Fort McHenry and try to invade Baltimore. And all through that night when he was on the British ship, he was worried about the fate of the nation and if the British would prevail. And in the morning and the dawn, he could see that the U.S. flag was still flying, and that indicated that the Americans had fended off the attack and that the nation would likely continue to endure as a sovereign nation. And that meant so much to him, seeing that flag and getting that communication from the flag flying, that he wrote that poem. And of course, those words then were set to music and became the lyrics to our national anthem.
And so that flag in that situation was really just a symbol of, a through line for communication, a very clear type of communication.
Correct. Yep.
Do we communicate with flags today in any way?
Yes, I think, you know, throughout history we have these iconic moments captured in photographs where that flag takes on that similar meaning that Francis Scott Key thought that it held for the nation's endurance. The famous photograph of the raising of the flag at Iwo Jima during World War II, one of the most famous photographs in our history. And then after 9/11, the raising of the U.S. flag within the rubble of, you know, the debris of that attack, and showing the endurance of the nation after that attack as well.
We have an email from Virginia who said, I would like to see a limit on the size of flags flown by businesses and private individuals. Virginia says, I believe that no flag should be larger than or fly higher than the U.S. flag and state flags flown on official buildings. There are businesses along major highways that fly huge flags. You can't tell me that it's all about patriotism, she says. It's advertising, and that is a misuse of our national symbol. What do we know about the ways we should handle flags?
There is an extensive flag code that you can look up pretty easily online with recommendations on how to display the flag or treat it as respectfully as possible. Everything from not allowing it to stay out in the rain, not allowing it to touch the ground, having it positioned in a certain way, always hoisting the flag above any other flag, including a state flag or even the United Nations flag. So, you know, that goes into the etiquette of our displaying of flags and our flag culture. But it does take on this sacred quality. The flag does have this sacred quality, and it's obviously a part, the biggest part of our civil or civic religion. So that sacred aspect of the flag comes from that reverence that we do show it.
Oh, there's a lot of ritual involved in the flag and how we fly it, even how we fold it. Certainly, I think of the military and those military funerals. How the flag is has to be folded in a certain way.
Yes, I think that just all goes to show the respect and reverence we have for the flag, how it represents the nation, and you know how it's such a symbol of our civil religion.
From your view as a historian, what does the history of a flag? What can that tell you about a state or a nation?
Well, I think it's important to not just focus on what Americans think of the flag. There are different opinions, of course, among Americans on the meaning of the flag, but also think about what people think internationally when they see the U.S. flag. There are mixed emotions, of course. Some people see the U.S. flag and think of the values of freedom and liberty and democracy, that they also want to belong to that or have that in their society. Other people may see the flag and it may represent to them imperialism or power or arrogance or exclusion from our borders because those people are considered non-American. So I think it's responsible on our part to acknowledge that it's not just what Americans think of that flag, but what everyone around the world also thinks.
We're exploring flag history, flag significance with UW-Madison historian Vanessa Cook as our guide. What does the American flag mean to you when you see the flag on someone's uniform? What do you think about? Do you love flags? Perhaps you are a scholar of flags. Are you in the North American Vexillological Association? This is my opportunity to say vexillology, and you can say it too. 800-642-1234. Back for more flags in just a moment after this news update here on the Ideas Network. We're talking flags here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The first official national flag was approved by the Continental Congress on June 14th, 1777. Each star represented a state, and each stripe represented the 13 colonies that declared independence from Great Britain. Flags at half-staff have become a universal symbol for mourning in our country, and the gesture is centuries old. Do you have a flag on display at your home? What is it? What does it represent? Did you or someone you love serve? What does the flag mean to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. Vanessa Cook is a history lecturer at UW-Madison, and she stays with us. Let's go to Barbara now, joining us from Fort Atkinson. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. My comment was that I have a neighbor who is flying their flag upside down on their flagpole. And it's very concerning to me because my understanding is when you fly the flag upside down, it is a sign of distress. And I was just wondering if your speaker could speak to that.
Barbara, thanks.
Yes, Barbara, that's also my understanding. I think that is would be a violation of protocol by flying it upside down. I've often read that it's a sign of distress, and so I could see how many people would take that as a sign of disrespect.
And maybe having a conversation, a delicate conversation with that neighbor to figure out what might be going on with flying that flag. Barbara, thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Tom now in Port Wing. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. In regards to the flag, I have admiration and honor for our flag. And my concern is that the incident, for instance, in Minnesota and St. Louis Park, where city councilors were more concerned about non-citizens being offended by our flag. And the reference on your program to, you know, we have to be careful how we address non-citizens. I don't think that should be a concern at all. This is our country. When many people marched in our streets carrying a Mexican flag, I thought that brought dishonor to our flag.
So, Tom, do you have a flag flying at your house?
I do not have one flying at my house right now.
Well, Tom, go ahead.
No, but I do have flags. Mm-hmm. I will put them out today. But when we have more concern for a non-citizen's flag, that brings disrespect and dishonor, I believe, to our flag.
And I think it goes back to, Vanessa, about putting the American flag above other flags on a pole.
Yeah, I think that Tom speaks to my point about how the flag can be such an emotional trigger for people, and it can be really a touchy subject for a lot of people and can even cause divisiveness among Americans as much as it creates unity.
What do we know about that divisiveness over flags?
Well, usually we think of a national flag as creating unity or symbolizing unity, but I think because of that sacred quality that I mentioned earlier, it does open a space for protest, for one thing, that people can, you know, get a reaction or call attention to issues by using the flag in a protest, whether by burning the flag or disrespecting it in some other way, refusing to salute the flag. Those extreme examples of burning the flag, for example, during the Vietnam War. I think one of the best ways that the U.S. flag was used in protest was the civil rights movement, the classic civil rights movement that we associate with Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks. It's interesting to think that that civil rights movement did not create their own flag and use their a unique flag for their cause. They actually rallied behind the American flag. And I think that's because it spoke to their cause of freedom and liberty and democracy, enhanced democracy for everyone. So they used that flag as a symbol of their cause.
What do we know about flags flying at half staff when a flag is lowered?
Yes, that happens from time to time, and there are a variety of designations about how long that flag should be at half staff, depending on the dignitary. If it was a president, I believe it's 30 days after the president's death that it should be kept at half staff, and that's different whether it's a senator or a governor or a civilian.
And Wisconsin's Governor Tony Evers issued an order yesterday to fly the U.S. flag and the state flag at half staff on Saturday, starting at sunrise and ending at sunset, to honor Nicholas Jans, who, a civilian worker who died doing work at the National Guard's Volk Field. So even, as you said, the time frame, but also sunrise to sunset, is there significance in that?
Yes, Ed, I'm sure that there is that part of the flag code. I'm not as familiar with that specific.
Flags can be the symbol of unity and loyalty to many people. It can also bring a nation together during tragedy. Why is that? Why is it so powerful to bring people together?
Well, it represents the nation as a whole, and so it's a symbol that we can all rally behind. It's part of the process of our historical memory. That's a collective process ongoing, but that's embedded in the fabric of that flag. And so I think it carries a lot of symbolism and can be a comfort to people in times of distress.
We're talking with Vanessa Cook. She is a history lecturer at UW-Madison, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 as we explore flags. What message are you trying to send as you put out your flag today? Do you identify with a particular flag, perhaps within the LGBT community? What does the rainbow flag mean to you, and how has the symbol helped you? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Vanessa, June was Pride Month, and Wisconsin raised the LGBT Pride flag over the state Capitol building for the first time in state history. What is the meaning in that?
Well, the Pride flag or the rainbow flag, that has a history going back to the mid to late 70s. It was created by a man named Gilbert Baker, or at least he's acknowledged as the creator. It may have been a more collective process among other gay rights activists in the 70s. But he was an artist living in San Francisco and active in the gay and lesbian rights movement there. And I think that flag, you know, it's associated with the gay rights movement, but it also very beautifully and simply represents diversity, not just of diversity among of sexual orientation, but ethnicity, race, gender. And so showing that there's strength in diversity, there's beauty in diversity, with those different colored stripes making up the rainbow flag.
Do you see it more commonly today? I mean, 1970s, that was a long time ago that this flag was developed and designed. How do we see flags perhaps become more common over time or not common?
Well, that one, I think, just it was so simple and yet so powerful in its message of diversity, using the rainbow as that metaphor. And it has become over time, just the last few decades, one of the most recognizable symbols across the globe. In fact, the Modern Museum of Art actually a few years ago designated it as one of the most recognizable international symbols, up there with, you know, the recycling symbol and other symbols that speak across languages.
Because of the rainbow colors and the simplicity of it?
Yeah, I think so. I think that design and the metaphor of the rainbow was pretty brilliant.
Hot pink was a non-standard color in flag fabric production, and perhaps I learned it deemed too costly to reproduce. So the turquoise and indigo stripes were also dropped in favor of royal blue. So there was even a lot of figuring out, you know, just a real practical thing there on, you know, what colors can we put in that can be affordable.
Yeah, I had heard that too, that the original flag, when Gilbert Baker designed it, originally had 8 or 9 stripes, including hot pink and turquoise. And when it was mass produced, you know, those colors were harder to recreate and mass produce. So it, you know, ironically was simplified for commercial reasons.
Let's take Paula now in Madison. Hi, Paula.
Hi. My question is, yesterday I was at a music thing, and there were 5 flags above the stage, and there were 2, you know, red, white, and blue, and then 2 red, white, and blue. But the one in the middle was a flag, a United States flag, but it was black with the red stripes were black, the white stripes were sort of a greenish color, like it might have been camouflage, and the blue stars. The stars were white, but the background was black. And I'm just curious about this. I don't understand. You know, it was our flag, but it wasn't the right colors. Is that an okay thing, or what might that be?
Yeah, that is unusual. I haven't, I'm not sure I'm familiar with that specific flag, if it is a reference to, you know, the military. Definitely not the standard colors that, you know, we would associate with the flag, the national flag.
Do we see variations like that at all, where people take the American flag and then put their own flourishes to it?
Yes, and you had mentioned earlier about the issue of advertising and how that's, you know, a sign of disrespect to the flag used in advertising. There was that controversy that broke yesterday, that story about Nike using the colonial so-called Betsy Ross flag on those sneakers and how they were recalled from production because of the outrage over that. I was unaware of the association of that with some right-wing white supremacy groups. I'm not sure how extensive that is or how recent of an appropriation that is. I'm not sure that flag should be hijacked from history in that way, or we should empower those groups to identify with it by calling attention to it. But it's also an issue of Nike using a variation of the U.S. flag in advertising, and that may have also stirred up some people.
We are on a tour of flags and their meaning through time. Vanessa Cook is a history lecturer at UW-Madison, and she's our guide. Do you fly the American flag where you live? Why is it important to you? And what do you think the flag represents? Do you identify with a certain flag? What does the rainbow flag mean to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Back in just a minute to this conversation here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about flags that fly over public buildings, over our homes. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and Vanessa Cook is a history lecturer at UW-Madison, and she is our guide to flags this hour. What flag is meaningful in your life? Are you a vexillologist? Do you study flags or collect them? Tell us about it at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to the phones now with Mark joining us from Bloomer. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind about flags?
It seems to me, in my experience, that the people who I know who get the most bent out of shape about the American flag or how it's flown and such are the people who, in my opinion, do not actually live up to the American values of accepting all people. Maybe we should be less concerned about the piece of fabric on the pole and more about our own actions and attitudes and beliefs and values. It's just a piece of fabric. It has nothing more than that. We need to live the values of our nation.
Mark, thanks so much for the call. Vanessa?
That's a very important point that Mark makes. I think the flag, you know, is a symbol and is an object that we take very seriously, but we should take those values more seriously and trying to live up to them and call attention to the shortcomings when they are apparent. And I think the flag can bring us back to those values. It's a constant reminder that they are there in our political culture. We claim them, and we should try to work on improving our society for everyone.
Let's go to Madeline now in De Pere. Hi, Madeline.
Hello. My brother was in the Chosun Reservoir battle in Korea. He was a Marine, and he was very proud of the flag. And my parents always flew the flag in the yard. But I feel like people, even Marines, are dishonoring the flag by being dishonorable. For example, Flynn was a Marine, and he was dishonorable. And I can understand those people who are flying the flag upside down, because when our people act in a dishonorable way, they dishonor the flag.
Madeline,
I can comprehend that.
I'm going to stop right there with Madeline, because what is the significance of our flag as we see it in the military? Vanessa?
Yeah. Yes, obviously many people who support our U.S. military and the troops display the flag prominently and associate it with honoring the memory of servicemen throughout our history. And I think we can think of it in two ways. The flag might seem abstract, and we can think of the military in just these abstract terms. But for many Americans, they think of it in very individualistic terms of that individual sacrifice and that individual life. And so it really personalizes the flag for them, where it's not just this abstract symbol, but a very personal message.
Yeah. Let's go to Lynn now in Hustisford. Hi, Lynn. Oh, I don't think Lynn is there anymore. You know, as we go through the flags, let's talk for a moment about the Confederate flag. There are other flags that are used as symbols of protection, and some people still fly the Confederate flag. What do we know about what it represents?
Well, the people who do continue to display the Confederate flag, more often than not, they will claim that it represents states' rights and nothing more. And that's true of other countries as well. When my husband and I were visiting Quebec City, we saw a number of Confederate flags displayed in apartment windows. And supposedly, you know, that was a way to bolster their own independence movement and their provincial rights for Quebec in their cause. So they were taking that flag out of its historical American context and using it for their own cause.
So completely different context.
Yeah, but still, you know, related to states' rights, but again, taken out of that historical context. And I think that is a danger and irresponsible to do that, because the Confederacy was not just defending states' rights. Of course, it was defending states' rights to continue the slave system and even extend it westward. And so, you know, you can't ignore that part of history that flag is embedded in. So I wouldn't say that everyone who displays a Confederate flag is a racist necessarily, but I do think they are advertising a determined ignorance of historical realities.
Let's go to Mary now in Wanakee. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I understand that there was a treaty that was signed between the United States government and the Republic of Texas, just as Texas became a part of the U.S. Part of that treaty indicated that both flags needed to be flown at the same height. Can you verify that for me?
I can't verify that specifically. That is interesting if it's true, because, you know, from everything I've read, the U.S. national flag should always be the most prominent, although there is a lot of pride in Texas, so I wouldn't be surprised if that state would demand that equal treatment.
Equal treatment, yeah. Oh, dear. Well, you know, there are all sorts of flags out there. You talked about the Pennsylvania flag, the Wisconsin flag. Are there flags, any even around the world, that are interesting to you, that are noteworthy, that we should talk about?
Well, there is, of course, the Olympic flag that is similar in showing unity, but not just within a nation, but across the globe. The five rings representing the five continents embedded or enmeshed together. And, you know, that flag is not flown for the purposes of battle, like flags are usually, national flags are usually used for, but proverbial battle in this more peaceful, athletic, nonviolent meeting of different nations.
Flags are such a powerful symbol at the Olympics. I mean, when you think of the Olympics, a flag, you see it in your mind's eye. And, you know, that's really beautiful to be able to see flags come together from all over the world.
Yeah, I think our emotional reactions to flags comes from this strange combination of both a primal reaction, you know, a primal reaction to seeing a symbol and or an image and reacting to that, but also a high concept intellectual reaction because of the concepts and the values embedded in that flag and that symbol.
I think I read that the American flag was changed 27 times based on as the states started coming in, westward expansion and all that. Do flags evolve over time? Are there tweaks to flags or once they're set, are they set?
No, there's always tweaks to flags. Of course, we had to change the number, or didn't have to, but it made sense to change the number of stars represented as we acquired more states. And then even the Wisconsin flag that we started out talking about this morning, that has undergone some minor changes in, you know, the design, the aesthetics of those figures, featured on the flag. But also more recently, I think in the 1980s, the addition of the word Wisconsin emboldened on that flag, and then the 1848, the year that the state was founded, emboldened in on that flag, which makes it a lot easier to remember the founding year of the state, since we see it all the time.
Right, right. You get those pertinent facts.
Yes.
So you don't have to scratch your head and look at the historian next to you and say, what was that about now? And so as we start wrapping up this conversation here, you know, from the historian's perspective, are there still more things we can learn from flags that really reflect on our history, that inform the way we interact with people in our country and around the world?
Yes, always. You know, I think it does, as I said, carries with it history. It carries our collective historical memory, and debates about the meaning of that will continue. We have to reconcile, like the last guest who was talking about, you know, issues of slavery and other more negative aspects of our history, along with the positive. We should acknowledge both in these celebrations and in these public rituals.
Vanessa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Vanessa Cook is a history lecturer at UW-Madison. Just ahead, we're taking a closer look at what it takes to build a vibrant community. Are you a volunteer where you live? How do you give back to your community? What does it take to keep a community vibrant? What does that really mean? Join in at 800-642-1234. It's coming up here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.